Welcome to Full Spectrum with JP, where we discuss the science that is behind the science that is invisible in the dark corners of the recesses of the secret space program, dark research of the 20th century. We find the full spectrum of science. Join us tonight. You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio. And welcome back. This is JP, and this is Full Spectrum Science. This is 16th of June. There's another one. 16th of the 6th, 2016. One of those palindromic weeks. If you're American, if you're British, it doesn't kind of work out right. But anyway, there's lots of ones and sixes and all sorts of things that are kind of springing out of today's date and today's times and the times that we're in. And at no greater time do we need to understand how energy works, how we can harness energy for ourselves rather than it getting sort of vaguely metered out by some imagined superior. So one of the empowering things that I wish to have, the intention of this program is to truly release energy for people. To that end, I have, the man I know that, as far as I know, the man who knows the most about getting off the grid in Britain and probably all over the world and all of the stuff, because he's investigated very deeply, and he does it as a living, and people paying for it, so he must know his stuff, plus his other experiences and inventions himself. So without further ado, Mr. Sir Dr. Wynne Keach, how are you?
Hi, JP. It's good to be back.
Yeah, Dr. Uber Gruppen, scientist. Yeah. Oh, so anyway, so where were we? We were talking last time about battery technology and, so since then everybody's been going like, oh yeah, it's great, but like £10,000, you know, can I start with 50p? So where would you like to take it this week?
Okay, yes, well, we can go back to batteries and start from there, if you like, about storage, and there are other ways of storing energy other than batteries. Obviously, batteries are a hot topic, because, as you know, the entire Western world is about to be inundated with electric plug-in hybrid cars, which are effectively the electrical consumption of a house with wheels. So, if you think in the UK, where we have about 2 million new cars a year, that's the equivalent of plugging 2 million new houses a year into the existing electric grid, which of course is going to cause extra demands and surges and load profile changes. So it's a big issue, and that thing's going to be over the whole of Western Europe and all the developed nations, really. So storage, energy balancing, is a huge issue with a huge cost associated, because all the grid systems in the street that you see running the street lamps and plugging your house into and running the industrial estate down the road, they've all evolved over the last 70, 80 years in countries like England for the purpose of supplying just those houses and those industrial estates. So when you start plugging in huge extra loads that have load demands at different times of the day, then you have a real problem, because you have extra peaks where you never had them before, and you have actually extra throughput through the cables. As a good example, tomorrow, the entire area around where I live here will be off-grid. I won't notice the difference because I am already off-grid, but they're having to put new electric cables through this area to supply it. So for the entirety of tomorrow, while they connect the new cables up, they have to disconnect the grid. So that's an example of an infrastructure cost. So just for the few square miles around where I live, they've just spent £35 million putting new cables in over the last 4 months. Now, that process is going to have to go on all over the world. And the report that I've seen says that globally, the required infrastructure improvement costs for on-grid living is approximately $17 trillion. And countries like the UK are looking at bills in excess of $1 trillion to upgrade their infrastructure. So much so that you may have seen things like the proposed high-speed train 2 link up the west coast of the UK, which you may think is, you know, interesting, a new train, it goes a bit faster. What's the real benefit? Well, the driver for that isn't the train, it's actually the electric system that powers it, because it can be used as a second grid system to run up the west coast of the UK. So that shows you the scale and the scope of the problem. So anybody that can generate renewables, store a little bit of energy and remove that load from the grid, if you can do that with enough people, then you can actually save this enormous problem and have a better world. So, so batteries are important. So what do you think, JP?
Batteries. Now, I've been battling with batteries. I don't know what it is about me, but whenever I buy a battery, it just seems to die. Right. No matter how much I try to take care of it, I try to keep it plugged in or not plugged in or overcharge it or don't overcharge it, they blow up. I mean, actually, I have to say, I did something, I must confess a stupidity the other day. So I got these, my internal household system, and I have a 12 volt rail and a 5 volt rail. And the 12 volt rail goes into the lights and lamps and stuff that go around the house, and the 5 volt rail goes to USBs. Like an idiot, I plugged a 12 volt supply onto the 5 volt rail and blew loads of things. Bam, 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 all these things that were plugged in trying to recharge themselves. And I was wondering, why is this taking 15 minutes to recharge and why is it so warm?
Yeah, that's why even with low voltage, you have to have a proper structure to the wiring you put in and procedures.
Indeed. And this brings us to the very esoteric subject of the charge control module.
Oh, yes.
I have a gentleman coming around to my house in a few days' time, and he's going to be wondering what the hell this thing is. He doesn't quite understand it. Why you would need this thing that's got these spider cables, and you go in there and you do all this. So for the benefit of him and maybe thousands of other people, what's a charge controller all about, and why do we need one? Why can't we just take out like the old car battery, we took the positive and the negative, why can't we just whack them on? What's wrong?
Well, different battery chemistries have different limitations and different problems. Now, everybody's familiar with the old car batteries and truck batteries, the lead-acid cell, which has a lot of advantages in that it is electrically robust and is very commonplace, easy to get hold of. It's very heavy, of course.
Well, that was a big one, wasn't it?
It was indeed. It wasn't my end. I don't know what happened.
I'm going to have a look at my logs, but I just got completely disconnected for quite a few minutes, which is very unusual. This hasn't happened for a long time. That kind of downtime. Anyway, welcome back. Welcome back. Now, we were talking about batteries and why batteries are important and why I destroy them. Why can't they hold a charge for me? I can't get a battery to hold more than 12 volts, you know. They're supposed to charge up to 13.5 or something like that. I can never get, you know, I've used one of these desulfators as well, you know. What's going on?
Okay, yes, I think your battery must have run down a few moments ago because we lost the line there. But yes, as we were saying, lead-acid batteries, everybody understands them, but not necessarily the mechanics of them. And one of the drawbacks is that they have a short life cycle, about 600 cycles for a reasonable battery, which is charging and discharging once a day for nearly 2 years. Even in a standby condition, they're only good for 5 to 10 years, and that's with a maintenance charge. The trouble being, of course, that when a lead-acid battery starts to discharge, then the acid in the battery becomes weaker and weaker. And when it does, the lead actually starts to corrode. because it's reactive to dilute acid, but not reactive to concentrated acid. So if you leave a lead acid battery stood in a discharged state for any length of time, then the battery will internally corrode and destroy itself. And similarly, if you discharge it too deeply, so for instance, if you discharge a lead acid battery more than 75% of its rated charge capacity, it will very quickly start to fail. If you discharge it 90, 95 or 100%, it could fail in as few as 20 cycles. So maintaining the charge on a battery is very important, and certainly on chemistries like lead acid. And on other chemistries like nickel metal hydride, for instance, you have other issues, which are, for instance, you don't want them to overheat. If you overcharge them, then they will overheat. A lead acid battery generally won't do that. A lead acid battery, for instance, will start to gas. It will start to break down the electrolyte into hydrogen and oxygen at the electrodes, and it will vent it out eventually. It will pressurize and then vent. And eventually you'll run out of the electrolyte in the battery, which, of course, if it's a sealed battery, will also ruin it. But nickel metal hydride batteries, they get rather hot if you overcharge them. So they have a fire risk problem if you overheat them. And the other thing with a nickel metal hydride battery is the internal self-discharge. Lead acid batteries, for instance, will self-discharge around 4% a month. So if you charge up a lead acid battery and stick it on a shelf, fully charged, at the end of a month, you'll have 96% of the charge you put in it, and then the following month, you'll have 92%, et cetera, et cetera, until it's eventually flat and then damages itself and dies. Nickel metal hydride batteries are a lot worse in terms of self-discharge. You can, for instance, charge to 100% a nickel metal hydride battery, but unless it's one of the latest technologies, the new hybrid technologies, then in as soon as 24 hours, you can lose as much as 20% of the charge, which isn't a problem if you have, say, an AA penlight battery running a pocket torch or something like that. That's not a lot of energy. But if you're running something on an industrial scale, such as an electric car, then that's a real problem. 20% of the capacity is an enormous amount of energy. And if you times that by 1 million or 2 million cars, you're talking entire power stations just losing the internal charge in the battery. So there's been a lot of research, therefore, into battery technology. So nickel metal hydrides of batteries have come along a little bit in that they now have what they call the hybrid cell, which were developed for electric cars. And they have a thicker membrane, basically, between the two electrodes within the battery, and that helps prevent the discharge. So those batteries can hold 90% of their charge for about a year, which is a huge step forward. So that is also an improvement. But when you get onto the lithium-ion batteries, you get into a whole new level of complexity with charging. So the first two batteries, quite resilient comparatively, but when you get to lithium-ion, especially the lithium carbonate batteries, then you have to be really careful charging them, because those are batteries that if you over-discharge them, or overcharge them especially, you can cause the things to burst into flames. So,
These are the laptops that have exploded from Sony, aren't they?
Oh, from all sorts of manufacturers, and also the same batteries that caused some of these cigarette vaporizers to explode in people's faces, and all these sorts of things. They are a fire hazard, which is why they have to be careful carrying them on planes, and they won't carry them as cargo in planes anymore. And even some of the planes, for instance, have those batteries. The new Dreamliner had a problem when it first came out, in that its own onboard batteries were starting to set on fire, because they were lithium-ion type batteries, you know, in a big pack. Now, the problem is that, you know, statistically, you'll have one cell that'll perform slightly better or worse than another. So if you have a big pack of batteries, so say you're using the standard laptop cell size battery into a big battery pack, say you have a 10 or 20 kilowatt battery pack for, say, a small electric car, then you're going to literally have 1,000 of these cells in your car. And you only need one to fail. If one is damaged mechanically, i.e. something pierces it, something crushes it, you go over a bump and you bump the underside of the car and one of the cells gets deformed, then a hot spot can develop and it can start to overheat. And because it can internally start to conduct charge, generate heat, and with the lithium carbonate batteries, when they go over 75 degrees C, they start to gas their own oxygen, and then they go into thermal runaway. And when they do this, they eventually burst into flames, and you can't put them out because they're producing their own oxygen for the fire. a bit like those underwater flares that you used to see divers carrying. And, of course, when one goes, then the series of batteries next to them go and the whole pack goes. So this is a real issue. This is why things like the Tesla electric cars, for instance, have a cooling system between all the cells to make sure this doesn't happen. But obviously people with less expensive battery systems won't have that level of safety built in. And this is why you come to these very complex charge controllers. When you get to the battery management system for large lithium-ion packs, then you have hundreds of connections going into these packs and effectively a small computer checking the voltage of each individual cell and making sure that each cell is charged at the correct rate and it's the correct voltage. So there are safer alternatives to lithium carbonate, for instance. There's lithium manganese, and there are also my favourite, lithium nanophosphate. And those two chemistries are far safer. They don't suffer from the thermal runaway until around 500 degrees C, which is a very good safety factor. But they're slightly more expensive, and their energy density is less, so they're less favoured for things like electric cars. Although the Nissan Leaf, for instance, uses lithium manganese. So some manufacturers are very responsible about this, and others are just going all out for range, and then they have problems. So, yes, battery management is important not only for safety, but also for the life cycle of the battery. So, for instance, if you took a high-grade lithium nanophosphate battery, you can get around 7,500 cycles out of them if you control them correctly. If you don't control them correctly, you may only get 2,000 cycles out of them. So that little gizmo with all the wires coming off, which is monitoring the battery, is making sure that you're getting the maximum performance out of the battery. And after all, the cells are comparatively expensive, so you want to get the best performance anyway. But the discharge level that the battery goes to is an important factor in the life cycle of the battery and the life of it, but also the discharge rate and the discharge rate profile, so the thermal profile, the thermal shocking, and the redeposition of the cathode and anode in the charging cycle. So, yes, all the battery chemistries have their own problems, and some of the battery chemistries have enormous problems, but are still useful. So, for instance, you may have seen the really toxic vanadium flow cells, for instance. Now, that's a system that works rather like you're used to putting petrol in the car, in that you squirt the charged electrolyte into the battery, and the battery stays, the battery plates stay as they always are, but you drain out the discharged electrolyte and pump in a charged up one. But that requires huge amounts of toxic vanadium salts, which of course isn't good if you crash your car and the stuff spills on the road, and at the end of the life cycle of the vehicle, you've got to get rid of all that and recycle it all, and all these kind of issues. There are other flow cell technologies, but they're not very well developed yet. Things like the zinc bromide ones, for instance. So they're inherently safer, but the technology hasn't got to a stage where it has the life cycle and the cost per cycle of equivalent battery systems. And then, of course, last but not least, is my favourite, which one I've been doing some work on, and one I will be doing more work on as time goes on, and that is the old Edison battery. The Edison batteries are fantastically electrically robust, and as a cheaper alternative to environments where you're not interested in the power-to-weight ratio of the battery, but are interested in the shelf life, a good cycle life, and electrical resilience, there's nothing to beat them.
Is this one of these crystal batteries?
No, not a crystal battery. No,
what's an Edison cell? I've never heard of an Edison cell.
Ah, well, they're a nickel-iron battery. Before the first petrol engine cars became popular, and the first oil-burning cars as well, and the diesel, the Daimler Benz machines, most cars were actually electric. They were effectively milk floats. And there was a battle on between good old Edison, who's, massive experimenter, not necessarily he gets there by innovation in the end, but he does it by trying 1,000 things to find the one that works. And he'd done a very good job, obviously, with light bulbs, world famous for inventing the light bulb. And in fact, some of his very first light bulbs are still working, the bamboo shoots, vacuum bulbs that he made way back when are still working. The oldest light bulb in the world is in a fire station in Detroit somewhere, and it's still working after 100 years. So Edison, after he'd made a good amount of money out of light bulbs, he was determined to develop the best battery system for the new sort of self-propelled horse carts, which are these electric pre-runners to the internal combustion engine cars that we have now. And the two competitors were the good old lead-acid battery, the traction battery, and the Edison battery. He invented his own. He tried everything he could find to come up with something that did the job. And he came up with a brilliant solution. And it's simply stainless steel perforated pockets of rust, which are nickel-coated on the other electrode in a alkaline solution. And he had these made up, and there are still some of the original ones working. They have a lifespan of up to 80 years. They're amazing things. They're only used in niche environments generally these days, such as mining lamps, because they're inherently electrically safe.
Yes. So.
So the only electric batteries you use down mines.
Down mines. So when, hang on, this like in, you know, sort of, let's go deeper into that. So. Edison has invented a technology that very few people know about. Is this something that is used in, like, you know, secret satellites or something like that?
No, it's something that's used in mining lamps and was used as an alternative to car batteries up till about 40 years ago, but in smaller quantities.
All right, so what's the cell voltage?
The cell voltage is very similar to the 1.2 per volt per cell of the lead acid battery. It's slightly higher. It's 1.5 volts, but it has a higher internal resistance, so it doesn't produce in its present form the same current capacity that lead acid battery does for plate size. But in areas where you have long discharge cycles, such as household storage, for instance, where you don't need huge bursts of energy from a very large battery system, but you want a battery system that's reliable, durable, comparatively low cost, and ultimately low maintenance, it's probably the best technology that's out there to this day.
Can we buy them?
You can. There are only about 3 manufacturers left in the world. There was a purge on the manufacturers. The lead-acid battery manufacturers that you know, you'll see as the trademarks, they bought up all the Edison battery manufacturers to put them out of business, because you buy one Edison battery and it lasts you a lifetime, whereas you buy a lead acid battery and you have to change it every 4 or 5 years. So there was a bit of a purge on them. And the traction battery, the lead acid battery, won as the battery of choice for these electric vehicles in the early days. It's simply because it had a higher current capacity for the size. But with modern technology reapplied to the Edison battery, it can easily outperform lead acid and bring in energy storage costs much lower than lithium ion. And it's something that I've now got 2 years work on. And given chance, when I get these other couple of products I'm working on now to the market, I'm going to return to this, because a large part of the world is going to end up being either locally off-grid or independently off-grid. For instance, if you were in a continent like India, for instance, where the electrical infrastructure is effectively the infrastructure, you know, the British put there 70 years ago. But you now have a country that's developing very rapidly in terms of technology and commerce, engineering, industrial capacity. There are now huge energy demands in areas which never had them before, and it's such a large country that it's a natural place, for instance, for localized solar wind generated power with local microgrids. But the issue with generating renewables is that renewables are intermittent, so you need storage, and storage is where the cost comes from, and that's where you have the maintenance issues. You don't want to be replacing tons and tons of batteries every few years. You need a battery that's going to last 15 or 20 years, and you preferably need it to be able to work in a wide range of temperature environments with very low maintenance requirements, that's electrically robust, because it may be that the people that are going to install it or maintain it haven't the same level of experience on them as, say, a German engineer. So it needs to have a certain amount of tolerance, whereas things like lithium-ion batteries, they are temperature dependent, and they have to be controlled to tight limits to work properly. So I'm a big believer in the Edison battery as a very good replacement for some of the existing battery technology where weight isn't an issue. You'll probably never see it in an electric car, but to power your house, power your village, even power industrial scale plants, it would be an absolute natural.
And would they be able to, now hang on a second, let me sort of clarify a couple of questions. It's a battery. Is it a accumulator cell or is it a generator cell?
It's an accumulator.
Right. So you have to charge it with your stuff, with your renewable energies.
Yeah, you charge it and it has a comparable cycle efficiency to a lead acid battery. A lead acid battery end to end cycle, you get about 75% of the energy you put back into it back out again. So it's of the same energy efficiency. Hmm. And the point is that it's made from materials that are less polluting, more widely available. It has an enormously longer shelf life. And the only maintenance on it is to change the electrolyte every 15 years.
15 years. And what is the electrolyte?
The electrolyte is usually just sodium hydroxide. Just drain cleaner.
So it's an alkaline battery technology.
It's an alkaline battery. So in terms of its operation, it's very much like the nickel metal hydride battery.
Mm-hmm.
But it's effectively just using rust.
Can they be homegrown?
Well, of course they can, because Edison was making them 100 years ago effectively by hand in an assembly line in New York. So, you know, it's something that was just thin sheet stainless steel that was punched holes in, folded around the iron filings, and then immersed in what was then just a rubber or wooden case. It's very simple to make, and it's quite easy to design an effective system using those components.
All right. So for instance, in terms of the size of something, so you're saying that it's equivalent to a lead acid battery. So you'd have 6 1.2 cells.
Yeah, it's roughly similar. It's got a slightly higher per cell voltage.
No, you'd need 10. No, a lead acid has 2.5 volts a cell, doesn't it, or something?
1.2
lead acid. All right.
Oh, sorry, 2.4 for the lead acid. 1.2 for nickel metal hydride.
So you need twice as many cells.
Yes, but it's a comparable voltage range for existing charge controllers.
Right.
But the only issue is that for high, short duration, high current delivery, which lead acid batteries are supremely good at,
mm-hmm.
you don't have that, so which also means that you don't have the same electrical fire problems internally with the battery. So if you need to have a higher current surge, say you have a very big inverter system, then you have to run more batteries in parallel to get the same current capacity.
Yeah.
But in terms of charge density and long duration discharge, they're eminently good. And they are available. You can actually get them as replacements for lead acid batteries. There's a Chinese manufacturer that makes them, and a couple of others. I think there's 6 worldwide at the moment. But they are effectively just the old format Edison batteries in a modern plastic case, really.
All right. So what would be a search term for looking for one of these? He says, poising his fingers above eBay.
Knifey, nickel iron.
NIFE battery.
Have a look at those. They're available for home storage systems. Because there are fewer manufacturers, they're more expensive at the moment compared to lead acid batteries. But in terms of the materials, there's no reason why at the same level of production they can't be at the same price or even less than the cost of a lead acid battery.
Get this. 12 volt bank nickel iron NIFE, 400 amp hours.
Yep.
10 by 1.2 volt cell. I hope everybody's sitting down. £2,105.26.
Yeah.
Plus £250 postage.
Yeah.
That's from Bimble Solar.
The point is you can make your own if you knew what you were doing.
What level of skill, let's say, what level of technical skill would it take to build one of your own NIFE battery?
If you did woodwork and metalwork at school, you could make one. If you knew what you were doing.
There you go.
All you need to do is be able to fold bits of thin plated steel, be able to pour rust into something, add the electrolyte, make a waterproof case, and away you go.
Hmm. Well, there you go, brothers and sisters. Maybe this could be one of these projects that, you know... Well, anyway, so, well, you can keep us up to date with... I mean, when you say you've been working on them, have you been building them yourself? Have you sort of gained that kind of experience, or are you using pre-created cells?
Yes, I've been building my own for subsystems for testing, because I'm hopefully redesigning them with a twist to make them more efficient than they are now.
Okay.
So I have two objectives. One is to make them less expensive and therefore more affordable, and also to make them more efficient in terms of their electrical design.
Yeah.
Because the design really hasn't changed greatly in 80 years, and it's a chemistry that has huge potential.
So there's, you know, we're talking about nano coatings that might improve the flux of electrons through the rust and stuff, yes?
It's no coincidence that I did invent the most efficient nano separation process in the world a couple of years ago.
Not only, but also.
Yes. There may be a slight correlation between those two facts.
Might work. So, oh. Who the hell's that? Oh, right, yeah. Yeah. I don't know how that. This phone is crazy. Right there. I think that's made it quiet.
So what else do you want to know about charge controllers, JP?
So yeah. So do these knifey batteries require charge controllers, or can you put 7 cells in or 10 cells in a row and then away you go?
Very, very good thing about Knifey is they are electrically super robust. You can't really overcharge them. And if you do, they just lose a little bit of electrolyte. You just add some water back to it at a later point. So unlike a lead-acid battery, well, with a lead-acid battery, for instance, if you overcharge them for great periods of time, then you actually degrade the surface of the plates. You etch them away. So Knifeys don't do that. Because they have very low mobility of the reactive components on the anode and cathode. So, the only thing you can damage is the electrolyte. So it's a very, very neat system for, especially low-tech applications and low-tech environments where you either can't afford or don't have, very complex and very expensive charge controllers. If you wanted, for instance, a renewable system where you wanted, say, an EMP-proof system, say you were worried about solar flares, for instance, and you were concerned that transistors in your charge controller could be a problem, Knifey would be a perfect solution for a 12-volt lighting system that was run off, say, an electrical generator or, you know, wind generator or something like that that didn't require a charge controller. You could actually, that is one battery you could actually charge and use without a charge controller. Every other chemistry you know needs a charge controller of some sort. Either it's just to stop it overcharging or over-discharging. Knifeys, you can run them completely flat. You can't overcharge them. You can charge them as much as you like and you can overcharge them. In fact, they tend to hold a 20% overcharge when you do overcharge them. So, of all those, it is the antithesis of the charge controller is the Knifey battery. But presently, because there are so few manufacturers, they are comparatively expensive for no good reason other than they're only made in small quantities for niche applications.
Wow. I mean, even a 5, well, when I say even, 5 kilowatt hour, £6,000. Wow. Oh, those are from the same company. But anyway, there's a 1950s advert for Knifey battery steel forklift truck.
Exactly.
Electric forklifts. Your forklifts. Your fork trucks need Knifey, it says here.
They do.
Batteries of steel. I love that.
they're super resilient, both mechanically and electrically. And they're low-tech, but very, very good potential as a technology if it was given the modern twist, that the techniques that we've used for redesigning modern batteries to allow better electrolyte penetration using nanoparticles, all those kind of things. If you can put that technology back into a Knifey battery, you'd have something that would outperform lithium ion, have none of the environmental problems, have none of the safety problems, and cost less.
Hmm. So this is where we start then thinking, okay, so iron is very heavy, the electrolyte's very heavy, nickel's not that bad. How How do we miniaturize this process?
Well, you don't need to miniaturize it. It's horses for courses. It's perfect for applications where you don't need to miniaturize it in terms of weight. So for electric cars, it's not really an appropriate technology. But if you're going to power your house, absolutely perfect. Absolutely perfect. It's something that you bring it in, you unload it from a truck, move it in with a forklift, you leave it there. It's so heavy, nobody's going to steal it. It's going to be there 80 years later and still working. That's what you want with a battery.
It's, okay, so it's not going to go anywhere. The battery that comes on wheels probably has probably got its own little, trolley. But incredibly expensive at the moment. So what have you discovered about this technology what have you discovered that you didn't expect so far?
What I didn't expect was that the technology hasn't really changed in 80 years. And there are modern approaches to battery design which can be applied to this technology. And as such, you can get comparable performance to lead acid, but with enormously greater life cycle length. And if they're made in the same quantities as lead acid, they should be for the same price or less per kilowatt hour. You have to understand that also 5 or 6 years ago, the lithium-ion batteries per kilowatt hour was the same price per kilowatt hour of NiFe as it is now. So, it's the Moore's Law thing. It's one of those things, it really isn't in the market. It's not really mass-produced at any level. And so it is comparatively expensive. But if it was widely adopted for the exactly the kind of environments that large-scale distributed storage is going to require, then it's definitely a contender for the future as a technology for batteries.
Well, that sounds marvelous because we certainly need something that, like you say, we don't want to suddenly flood the energy market. So what we're talking about is a gradual movement from the greatest energy demand is going to be on the road rather than in the house.
Yes, houses are getting more energy efficient as you start removing some of the year-round loads, such as changing light bulbs from normal incandescent bulbs to LED bulbs, for instance. Mm-hmm. More efficient refrigeration in your fridge freezer. All these energy saving advances reduce the average yearly demand for a house, whereas the range requirements and the performance requirements for electric cars are such that their energy demand is going up and up. So it's actually running counter to the savings in houses and house heating, house electricity, and it will be a big issue, especially when you have manufacturers like BMW that say that within 6 years all their cars are going to be plug-in electric cars. You have countries like Norway that say that by 2020 all the cars on the road are going to be plug-in electric cars. So that's a huge electricity demand that's about to occur.
So we really need to start, for a start, I think, distributing the generation of power to smaller and smaller. I'm a great fan of nano generators, as you're probably aware. You know, we've been talking about this before, that if you can find a way of generating power on site from something that is in abundance, you know, there might be a stream coming by that you could put a mill in or something.
Yep.
So if there's a way of channeling the natural energy around. Now, in the chat room, one question was from Matt Mann in Arizona. Do you have info on Earth batteries? I've heard that the early telegraph system ran on them. Is there a potential for appreciable amounts of energy for modern needs?
There certainly is. It's one of my favourite subjects. The Nathan Stubblefield ground battery. Absolutely ingenious and misunderstood largely. Yet there is an enormous potential for this. It's actually something I've actually done work on. There is the problem is people misunderstand both Tesla's work in energy transmission and where it came from. For obviously the chap in the chat room knows all about this, but for the listeners that haven't, this is a fascinating subject, which hopefully I can just spend a few minutes talking about. Back at the time of the telegraph, when the telegraph was the internet of the day, it was the way that merchants could get information ahead to be able to make money on the market as to, you know, which ships were coming in with what goods from overseas on one side of the country to the other. It was the technology du jour, the communication technology par excellence, and there was huge investment in it. It was, you know, after the railway, it was the next big boom in the States in terms of technology. And they set about running cables all over the States, and they were usually iron cables, and they started out with two wires, just iron wire that was exposed to the elements, nailed to wooden telegraph poles. And the first systems were at the route of the telegraph poles were actually defined by geomancers. So they naturally followed the energy lines of the planet when they put the systems down. Now, very interesting things started to happen because of this. The first thing is, they noted the telegraph engineers, very pragmatic people, and day-to-day running this telegraph system, they were absolute experts on the system they were running. And through observation, they found, for instance, that when one of the wires broke, if the wires were touching into the wire that broke was touching to the ground at either end, it still continued to work. And using this, they realized that by sinking a plate into the ground at either end of the telegraph, they could save one of the wires, which was an enormous cost saving when you've hundreds of miles of iron wire to nail to a telegraph pole. So this was the origination of the grounding system, that, you know, the earthing system that we have in houses, which people don't generally think about. You know, it just goes to a pole in the, that's hammered into the outside of the house in the garden somewhere, or in the drive to your house or something. And in the event of live mains going awry in your house, the entire current of it is carried back to the electrical generation system by that little pole in your garden. Now, that's quite astounding when you think about it. Now, Nathan Stubblefield grew up as an assistant to a telegraph operator, and he learnt about grounding systems. Now, the electrical current in the ground are carried by what are called telluric currents, which are the flows of energy near the surface of the actual underground that we're standing on. There is a thing, electrical thing called a ground plane, which surrounds everything touching the earth. And beneath the surface, when you go beneath the insulating air gap and you get into the ground, you actually have the telluric currents, which are ground energy flows. It's like sort of free range wiring. It's just energy drifting around, usually at lower density, but often in trained paths, which are usually entrained by things like underground streams, which start an ionization path, which the energy then starts to flow along. Now, Stubblefield was working with the old telegraph operators, and this is sort of 30 years after the initial boom with the telegraph. And some of the cables were starting to snap all over the place. You know, they just fatigue and snap in the wind and fall apart. But of course, the Marconi was now coming on with radio, so the telegraph systems were being worked to death to recover the investment in them, because radio was replacing them. So there was no further investment in the telegraphs. Now, the point is, your wire's broken 100 miles away from you, and it's got another 200 miles to go. You would expect that when the second wire broke, that the current carrying capacity of the telegraph would break. But the old telegraph operators found that not only did it not break, it actually worked better than when it was wired with the wire. Nathan Stubblefield saw this, and he was also an actual geomancer, incidentally. And he gleaned from this that what had to be happening was that because the wire had been in the place for so long, the energy stream had entrained along the wire. So the signal was actually going down the outside of the wire and being carried by the natural environment as much as it was being carried by the wire. And when the wire broke, because the current was continuous from the batteries that they drove these systems, they started out with basically big dustbin size batteries that they buried in the ground to power the telegraph continuously over a 30-year period. But because the current was continuous, the signal remained continuous. which is very counterintuitive, but obviously Stubblefield grew up observing this, and the old operators told him about it and explained it to him. And he took this, and he did an amazing thing. And it's now just the, I think it was 2 years ago, it was the 100th anniversary of it. Nathan Stubblefield took this and made the ground radio system, the ground telephone. So just using two wires and very simple, sort of hand-wound, hand-built electronics of the age, which were just, you know, wound resistors and capacitors and that sort of thing, he actually built the first mobile telephone. I.e. a telephone, you could stick two electrodes in the ground, and up to 3 or 4 miles away, you could stick two other electrodes in the ground, and you could have a telephone conversation. And not only that, he designed a battery that powered it, a ground battery, which, when you look at it, you would think that it's an electrolytic battery, but it isn't. It's actually a battery that uses some of the ground energy that's flowing past it to power the system, and it was enough to power this telephone system continuously. And it's a very interesting thing. It's a three-coil system, just, you know, just wound on a wooden bobbin and put into the ground. And it's very interesting how it works. And it's something that I've studied in great depth and something that I will be designing a product to use, because there, the energy stream he's using, there is, by my calculations globally, available as free, non-polluting electrical energy in the ground, 2.5 terawatts, which is enough to produce basic energy for every man, woman and child on the planet to run a small house. That's available. And it's something I will be doing.
Terawatts. That's power, my friend.
Yeah, terawatts. That's a lot of power.
So, again, these are things that you can do with relatively household objects. You know, a metal pole and a galvanized pole, you know, iron pole and a galvanized zinc pole or something?
Absolutely. Well, if you think back to that era, if you look back 100 years...
Yeah, they didn't have...
The level of technology that was available, if you were lucky, you'd have access to a lathe.
Yeah.
Or a handsaw, or, you know, a bit of wire. You know, they don't have the widely available technology that we have now. So all these technologies from that era are very fascinating.
Mm.
Now, the interesting thing, if you study Stubblefield, is the place that Tesla got his idea for his magnifying transmitter system was actually Nathan Stubblefield. If you look at it, he went to study it. He went to study Stubblefield operating his telegraph system, or his telephone system to be precise. And you can see photos of Tesla actually looking at demonstrations of Stubblefield demonstrating the telephone system. The difference being, Stubblefield was an intuitive and a sensitive. So he designed it according to how he felt it should be, but didn't necessarily know how it worked. He just knew that it did, and refined it until it worked well enough for his purpose. Tesla, of course, being a genius mathematician and practical scientist, knew exactly what was going on. He took the principle, because he suddenly realized the way the thing had to work. And that was the basis for all the work that Tesla did on the magnifying transmitter, the Wardenclyffe Tower, all of that. The energy he was using is actually in the ground. It's not in the air. He only used the air as a capacitor system to drive the ground system.
So he just used it, he used the tower to separate it from the ground. Yeah?
Yes, he used the tower to separate the ground frequency energy from the air frequency energy. Mm-hmm. And the dome that everybody thinks is transmitting the energy actually is a spherical capacitor, which is simply storing the energy in the air around the top of the tower, because mm-hmm. it's going to pump it back into the ground.
Yeah, it's like a kind of spring, isn't it?
It is like a spring, which he was very interested in resonant systems.
Yeah.
So, and he did a lot of work on studying resonant earth energies. He was looking, measuring lightning strikes around the planet and how it disturbed the earth energy, for instance.
Yeah. And Tesla as well is, of course, famous for inventing the Tesla coil, which is like most people coil like a bobbin, but of course Tesla wired flat coils.
Yes, well, Tesla was using air as the magnetoconducting fluid between the two sections of the coil. So when you see what he's doing with the spherical capacitor, you also realize that he's basically using a Tesla coil system backwards and injecting it into the ground. Whereas everybody presumed, because lightning and the like was coming out of the top, that he was transmitting it from the top, rather like Marconi. But Marconi was using and systems that Tesla previously invented that he discarded as being inefficient. And of course Marconi used the trick of the ground currents to transmit across the Atlantic. It was a piece of showmanship that he used, which unfortunately resulted in Tesla having his investment cut off. But that's why the early Marconi stations were all geomanced and all put on points of high ground energy, because the majority of the signal was actually going through the ground. It was the signal transmitted through the air by the systems was far too small to actually be detected.
So it's
a fascinating history.
Indeed. So, for instance, if you were to have one of these units, and I was to have one of these units, mm-hmm. I could hammer a couple of sticks into the ground. They would form a ground battery, power the thing, and then also be my ground connection, my antenna connection that takes me into some kind of electrical connection with somebody else, say you, down there in Whitby or wherever you are.
Yep.
That we could have a private conversation that couldn't be overheard?
Absolutely. It self-segregates in a sort of multiplexed environment. So the way it tends to work is that you have basically a search signal. So something like Marconi transmitting the radio signal, however weak, establishes the connection by a second channel. And then when it has then fed back through the two connection points, the main connection then takes over. And so long as you maintain the energy between the two connections, that connection will stay. It will stay fixed, even if you move the two points. Stubblefield is even testing the system on boats, for instance, just trailing two wires out of the back of a boat from one ground station to the boat. And the boat moving across the lake still entrained the signal once it had been established. The key to this is keeping the connection established. So this is quite an unusual system in that if you don't use it, you lose the power. Once you've established the connection, you have to continually draw some power to maintain the operation of it.
So you have to set up some sort of a background bed that keeps the system alive.
Yeah, you have to have a management system that makes sure it keeps dumping a small amount of energy to somewhere so that it keeps the connection alive once you've established it. And in fact, the connection takes some time to establish also. I mean, Stubblefield took around a fortnight to establish an initial connection.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize that was what you mean. It took, when you said, so can you talk about the process? How does it establish connections? I mean, for instance, again, take the example of you send me a box, right, that has some kind of speaker and microphone in it, right? Mm-hmm. And then it's got a couple of wires coming out the back of it, and I put those wires into the garden, and mm-hmm. then what?
Well, that's what Tesla was doing with the magnifying transmitter. So he'd send you a box with a tuned receiver, and you'd hammer an electrode into the ground and one into the air, and his magnifying transmitter also had the secondary function of sending out a radio signal, which would set up a little resonant radio signal grid across the planet. And once you're tuned into the correct frequency, it then entrained the main connection through the ground back to the rest of the magnifying transmitter that was injecting its signal into the ground. So basically the magnifying transmitter was forming an artificial telluric current system. It's kind of like an overlay to the natural system. The natural system is more chaotic, but within short ranges, you know, 3, 4, 5 miles, you can use the system to easily establish a connection. And Stubblefield's basically mobile telephone system worked perfectly in that environment. He was installing them in farms in places like Kansas, where you'd have the telephone in the speaker and microphone in the house in a wooden box, and it would be on continuously, and you'd be able to talk to the neighbor's farm or wherever the other end of the telephone was. So yes, that's one way of doing it, but that's a comparatively low amount of energy. The systems I'm looking at systems that can power your house, and that is an engineering reality that can be done. That is your planet generating electricity, providing it to you completely eco-friendly at a level that you can support the basic structure of society in terms of domestic living across the planet without having any environmental impact at all. And
without the need to dump the fly ash in the sky.
Well, without the need to do anything. It's just waste electricity. You have to understand that the planet we're sitting on is enormously electrically charged. You know, we are the birds sitting on the high voltage power lines saying, where's all the electricity then? You know, there is no energy shortage. The planet is an enormous electrical generator. It's taking the high energy solar wind. It's taking it to the poles of the Birkeland currents. It's then distributing that charge across the crust of the planet, which is sitting on a molten core, which is an insulator. And that charge is then leaking off it in the form of lightning at the rate of 150 strikes a second. So it's a colossal amount of energy. And it's going to waste, and it can be tapped. I know how to do it. Tesla knew how to do it, and a lot of other people do, I'm sure. Most of them never brought it to market because the commercial force has stopped them. The difference is I'm quite willing to give it to the world. That is the difference.
And that's the Tesla way.
Mine's actually a more natural way than Tesla's.
Yeah.
Tesla did it the way. There is another way of doing it, and that's something I've been researching.
So, do keep us appraised. I mean, how far have you got? I mean, have you got to a thing that you can... I mean, it's all about, can you stick it in a box and send it through the post?
Not at this moment in time. It's a little bit more critical in terms of its engineering, but yeah. In terms of proof of concept, mm-hmm. Yes.
So what have you got? Well, I mean, how much voltage and current and joules are you drawing? Or
I'd rather keep that to myself at the moment in time.
All right, okay.
But initially from small amounts, then yes, there is good amount of energy available. If you look at other variations on this theme, if you look at systems like T.H. Moray, I don't know if you know of his work.
I've heard of someone called Moray, and I actually live in the county called Moray.
Indeed you do. Yeah. Now, Moray was interesting. He was actually working on I don't think he understood that he was, but he didn't understand where the energy was coming from. He was trying to refine crystal radios, and he suddenly found he set himself the task of trying to get a crystal radio that could power a loudspeaker, which he did. He achieved about 26 watts to his surprise. And wow. From further refinement, he was a superb electrical engineer, very highly trained, you know, as a theoretical electrical engineer and physicist. And he came up with a system that eventually was about the size of a small coffin, a wooden box with comparatively simple components in, that he was able to generate 50 kilowatts of electricity continuously. And that was using valve stages and his own custom-made diode. He was probably the first person to make an industrial-scale diode. He went to Sweden and found some materials that worked more efficiently than selenium did as a diode, and he made his own rectifier for this system. But using modern knowledge and modern materials, the Moray system would also be appropriate. And what our system was doing was the same process that Tesla was. The people overlooked the ground connection to it. And what it was actually doing was causing a resonance between the air cavity, which has a much higher frequency resonance, and the ground cavity. And because of that, it was working as a kind of bucket brigade, multi-stage converter in the box. But the back EMF, as it were, was a harmonic of the air frequency being pumped back into the ground, and that caused it to resonate with the telluric currents in the ground. And so that was the out of equilibrium resonance of the system was what was enabling it to capture some of the electricity from the telluric system in the ground. And it had such a relatively high local voltage that it was able to coupled to quite a large area of ground, and that's when he got his systems up to about 50 kilowatt with a quite a long antenna. He had a single wire antenna of, you know, sort of 50 or 100 yards long and a ground connection, but nonetheless he was getting 50 kilowatt out of the thing.
That's very impressive, and that's certainly plenty. You could run a small factory with that.
Yeah, but the electricity is a different texture to the kind we're used to, in that it's
so
low current, very high voltage.
Low current, high voltage. So you'd need to, could you dual feed this into something useful?
Well, that's effectively what he was doing. His box was like a multi-stage dual thief.
Uh-huh.
But
can you explain to people what a dual thief is? Because it's not people who steal jewelry.
Okay, a jewel as in a jewel of energy.
J-O-U-L-E.
J-O-U-L-E, indeed. A jewel thief is simply a coil system with a transistor switch, which takes low voltage, such as a small battery, and switches it through a resonant coil to produce a higher voltage on the output, which, for instance, if you have a primary battery, like a zinc carbon battery, for instance, that's running down, that is probably normally only usable down to, say, 0.8, 0.7 of a volt, but there's still energy in the battery. Whereas a jewel thief can still operate even at those very low voltages and get and extract more energy out of the battery through the resonant stepping up of the voltage to make it into a useful kind of chopped DC coming out the other side. And so that's quite a well-known and quite interesting little circuit that's useful for playing around with battery systems and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But the opposite of a jewel thief, to drive it the other way, is like a bucket brigade, where you take a high voltage and you put it through a resonant decoupler to produce a lower voltage stage, and on and on and on. And that's really what Moray's box was doing. It's taking electricity coming in off the antenna at around 250,000 volts. And stepping it down to 110 volts that was being applied to, you know, electric ions, light bulbs, that kind of load, at appreciable current. So you're taking something that, you've an energy loss through the system, but a lot of it's high voltage switching and it's comparatively efficient, although they were through valve stages and his own custom diode, which was an enormous thing. It's the size of a flashlight. But those are the two tricks. The real tricky thing was he was well ahead of the curve on designing his own diodes. And he was a clever electrical engineer, and he made a very good valve bucket brigade decoupling system. And he was able to design it so that it could be tuned. And once he'd got the air cavity tuning in tune with the ground cavity, then he's got a resonance system that's generating a lot of electricity, and the bucket brigade is then just pumping it out. But it's still, it's still electricity of a different texture, is the only way I can describe it. It's a bit like Tesla's white fire, in that it has more of a longitudinal texture than the normal transverse EM signal that we're used to.
More longitudinal than transverse.
Yes.
Mr. Keats, please, again, I have an idea of what that is, but...
Waves go down wires. People think, first, people don't misunderstand how wires conduct electricity for a start. Most of the electricity going down a wire goes down the outside of a wire if it's any thickness. And that's why, for instance, if you have power lines, the center of them are actually tend to be hollow and generally filled with paper, bizarrely enough, because it's one of the world's best insulators. Because after an inch of thickness of conductor, adding extra thickness makes actually very little difference to the actual current capacity per weight of the cable.
So indeed, you could make cables that had enormous amounts of data carrying fiber down the middle of them that would act as a, you know, that you could lay your power cables plus, I mean, if you were going to make a big grid that you could include the data going down, that it'll just actually be like a great big USB, wouldn't it?
It already does, JP.
They already do that. All right, okay.
They conduct most of the internet traffic across the country. A lot of it's really the local trunk that is on the cable. The majority of it actually goes up and down the mains power lines.
And is that superimposed on as a carrier, on a frequency?
Of course, it's a completely different frequency range. It's several orders of magnitude away.
Yeah, so multiple gigahertz, terahertz.
Just injected and then removed at the other end. But no, the point is conductors, thin conductors, yes, you can model those as going down a small pipe. But when you get to thick conductors, the most electricity is actually conducted around the outside of the conductor. And when you get to things like high voltage longitudinal electricity, it's conducted along the skin of the conductor. So you get a different kind of engineering and a different texture to the way the electricity goes down the cable. So
yeah, it's like the way electricity goes across our brain as well. It goes across the surface, doesn't it?
Well, yes. So if you look at the model of how electricity works, you think, oh, there's electrons whizzing down these pipes at light speed. Well, no, actually, they're not. The electrons going down the actual conductor are going about a tenth of the speed of light speed. It's the electrical signal that's going at light speed. So the excitation, the wave front of the that's exciting all the electrons in the outer shell of the metals as it skips along is going at light speed, but the actual electrons themselves are drifting at around a tenth of the speed of light, and sometimes less.
Yeah, so you could liken that, like if you had a saw a bottle in a river, you see that the bottle flows along, but the waves in the river are going much faster, and the bottle's bobbing up and down, but it's not going as fast as the waves are going, but it's going as fast as the medium is going.
Exactly. So although people tend to model and think of electricity traveling, especially through electromagnetic systems, as being the electron flow through the conductor, actually it's the wave traveling through the conductor that's and interacting with the metal valence that's producing the electromagnetic effect. It's not strictly the electrons doing it. And longitudinal electricity, which we've overlooked since the 1950s in the Western world, apart from Russia, which is very up on it, Mr. Tesla was very, very keen on, is just the other half of Maxwell's equations of electromagnetic theory that everybody forgot about. And that's just another waveform of electricity that has different properties. And certainly ground energy has more of a longitudinal texture to it in terms of how it performs and how you have to engineer its systems to operate it than traditional, transverse electricity that we're used to with radios and mains generation and that sort of thing.
Okay, so.
So ground batteries.
Ground batteries.
Very, very useful things. And there's a lot of people tinkering about with them. There aren't that many people out of all the people that are tinkering that fully understand how they work, which is a shame. But people, I think, are generally becoming more aware. Certainly, my experimentation with it says that there's huge potential for this. And yes, I can see that within a decade, I could produce an engineered system that would be a viable alternative to, say, a solar cell.
Well. That's
because
you've
got to understand that the entire planet is a solar cell, effectively. It's collecting the solar wind, and it's actually producing the electricity. It's doing two-thirds of the function of a photovoltaic electric system. It's just taking electricity out of it when it's produced it, and the telluric currents are the way to do that.
So, telluric currents, how can you visualize these things?
If you can imagine if you could see into the floor, so if you can imagine the ground you were standing on for the first 45 feet was see-through, and you look through, you would see hundreds and hundreds of free-running streams of water that just mingled and swept along the way in different paths at different levels. That's how telluric currents would look, until you come to something that entrains them. So normally they would be chaotic and in different directions, and flowing, just like water. But if you imagine that there was, say, an underground stream, those flows would merge and follow it. They wouldn't actually become part of the stream, but they would follow alongside it, and they would draw all the little friend streams of energy along with them until they were all going down it, almost as though they were sort of surfing on the top of the pipe, as it were. And so those are your trunk points. Those are the points where you wish to connect to the ground, and it expresses itself in different ways. The earth energy, I actually have a meter for measuring this. You can see the wave function of where these things go, and there are node points approximately every 6 feet across the entire surface of the planet. It's called the Hartmann grid, and you can actually measure it. It's slightly distorted north, south, east, west because of the electromagnetic properties of the planet, because it's magnetic field, but there are node points about every 6 feet. So if you can detect where a node point is, and you can put the electrode in, which Stubblefield knew how to do. He was a sensitive, he was a dowser, and that's what he used to do.
That's
he used to
right. connect. I'm quite aware of the Hartmann grid.
Yeah, yeah. So he would find a node point for one of his electrodes, and he'd connect the other one to something like a tree, which is a very good way of connecting to ground. And away you go. Interestingly, if you ever tried listening to trees electrically, it's quite astounding. I was, as you know, I used to do a lot of work on crop circles because I was interested in what energy was creating the ones I was seeing happening. And certainly the earth energy is an enormous part of that. And one of the early pioneers of crop circle research was a very nice man called Pat Delgado, who unfortunately passed away a few years ago. And before he passed away, Pat asked me to do some research for him, which I did. He was also come to the same conclusion that there was something coming out of the ground that was, in terms of energy, that was being used here by consciousness. And he started experimenting and quite simply listening to the energy in the ground. And he asked if I would go away and replicate his research, which I did. And it's astounding. If you take a small electrode, say you took a 6-inch long screwdriver blade and you clip a crocodile clip to it and you stick that in the ground, and about 10 or 20 feet away you just put an electrode into the trunk of a tree, and you just put a tape recorder on that, or camcorder audio input, or digital audio recorder, whatever, to that signal, you'll find that not only is the signal, that signal strong enough to actually light a small LED bulb, it's quite a strong electrical signal, it's in the audio frequency range, and it picks up all kinds of signals. Interestingly, the primary signal seems to be at 23.6 kilohertz, which is the same communication frequency as the bottlenose dolphin, for instance. But Pat was noticing, and I've replicated this, that ground energy system is picking up all kinds of man-made electrical signals as well, and carrying them. So just by having an electrode in the ground, you can actually listen to radio signals that are being picked up and transferred by the telluric currents, and you're listening with no more than a small electrode in the ground and a tree. It's quite astounding. If anybody wants to have astound themselves, just go and try that. It's quite amazing. I can see you probably doing this tomorrow morning, JP.
Where's that cherry tree, you little bastard? Growing. I did a little calculation, and that frequency is an F sharp.
An F sharp? Yes. That's interesting. I measured it 23.6, the ones here locally out of the tree I was listening to.
So let's just talk about frequencies of things. So for instance, say you've got your Wardenclyffe tower, your electrode up in the air, your big electrode. What is the frequency band that it's picking up on?
Right, well the bit in the air is in the air cavity, and that's got a sort of primary frequency of around 220 kilohertz.
220 kilohertz, right.
Yeah.
The ground side is
at the Schumann frequency of, resonant frequency of the planet, so that's between, we used to be 7.5 hertz, it's now up to about 14 and it's going higher. So it's in the kind of ELF band.
So these are many octaves away.
Yes, so what he's doing is he's creating, basically, an injectable, they use in cooking. It's an expanded, Tesla coil system where one part of the energy system is the air cavity storage and the other side is the ground energy storage. And what he's doing is he's getting the primary resonant frequency of the air system at a harmonic of the air cavity, but also at a harmonic that's an overtone of the Schumann resonance.
Yeah.
So he's pumping the energy into the spherical copper capacitor on the top of the tower. The air locally is storing it in quite a large area, and that's why you occasionally got lightning strikes coming out of the thing and the field is breaking down. So that shows you how much energy he's storing up there. You're looking at 30,000 volts per centimeter. It's very high voltage, and quite a wide storage area. And on the next cycle of the ground, so the system is tuned to be resonant to the Schumann resonance of the ground. When that signal, which is being excited at 220 kilohertz, and stored locally in the capacitor. So he's storing that energy 220,000 times a second into the air cavity. He's taking that energy and he's pumping it back down through the Tesla coil, which is designed so the two coil systems are the coupling, the coupling in terms of the Q factor between the two sides of it. And he's injecting that as a high voltage, really high voltage, you're looking at a couple of million volts, into the ground. And that's then going down basically 90 meters of steel piping that he has driven into the ground. The most expensive and elaborate part of the Wardenclyffe Tower system was the underground antenna system. He built 90 meters into the ground, 6 foot wide iron pipes. Which then went out into a circular radius. And that's where he's pumping the energy into. He's pumping the energy really into the top 90 meters of the crust, because the crust is acting exactly as we were talking about thick conductors. The energy and the frequency range of conduction of the crust of the Earth is dependent on the depth and the material it's made from. So really in the top 45 to sort of 100 meters of the crust is where all the electrical activity is taking place, because what you have is the planet is in fact a huge spherical capacitor which is being charged from two poles, and the charge is flowing across the surface of the surface conductor through the capacitor plate, which is the crust. But because the crust is so thick in real terms, rather than this aspect ratio of course, it's only being conducted really in the top 45 to 100 meters. Beneath that, the electrical activity is comparatively small in terms of the energy transmission. So if you can imagine, if you can imagine a capacitor plate, you'll have played with capacitor plates, JP. You can imagine that when you put an electrical charge on it, the charge spreads over the plate at high speed and charges the whole plate up, and the energy is stored in the vicinity of the plate, either in the dielectric of the air or whatever dielectric you place between the two plates. If you can imagine taking that and folding it into a sphere, and then in the middle of the sphere you have a molten insulator, that is the planet. And what's happening is the electrical charge is coming in at the two poles, and so there's continuously a charge flowing across the planet. And it's going across that capacitor plate, and the telluric currents are the kind of spider web, almost like a mushroom fungal web of electrical pathways that over time have built up with the flow of the energy, which is travelling more as a dark low-grade plasma than it is as clumps of electricity. So once it's formed its own little natural trunking paths, it will continue to follow those paths whilst ever the planet continues to generate electricity, which it has done for billions of years. And that network's just there for connecting to. You just have to connect to it electrically. And you just really have to have an understanding of that process and the imagination to be able to say, how do we do it? And, I've made some experiments and it looks practical.
Now, so, are we going to have a Wardenclyffe of Whitby?
Well, the point is you don't have to have a Wardenclyffe.
You can do it on a much smaller level, yeah?
I'm looking at, as usual, I try to make things that are affordable, practical, and appropriate. What Tesla was trying to do was have a central point for communication, because it was the age of radio. Radio was obviously the competitor to his technology, and he invented the radio himself in the first place. But it was all about communication. It was the internet of its day. In fact, it was the internet 2 of its day. The telegraph was the first stage. Radio was the second. And Tesla could only raise money with the technology that the investors understood, which was radio. So he built the proposition for his system as an information transmitter, a sort of super radio transmitter. But he knew full well it could do a lot more, and that the radio transmitter was just the way of achieving an entirely more complex and sophisticated energy transmission system that he could run through the ground at the same time. So he envisaged that you would buy a Tesla resonant box on a stick, and you drove the metal stick into the ground, and you just simply tuned it into the antenna, and the tiny signal in the antenna coordinated it to the ground signal, and then away you go, and it would power light bulbs. And in fact, he did. I mean, he spent a lot of time in Colorado lighting light bulbs 10-20 miles away. He was transmitting energy all over the place, and there are clues. And I mean, when he was did his first test in Colorado, which was smaller than the Wardenclyffe system, the locals were complaining that there were lightning bolts jumping out of the ground, which shows you exactly what Tesla was playing with. He was playing with the telluric currents. He was kind of overdriving them, and to the point that he was scaring people. but that's how he envisaged it happening. So he envisaged that he could have a system that could not only communicate, so he could send a radio signal, but he could also use that system to generate local electricity. And it would have worked quite nicely, but obviously things weren't to be. Marconi stole his thunder with a bit of showmanship, although he was still using the technology that he'd learnt from Tesla. He was a student of Tesla, And in fact, it was some time, it was only in the last 20 years, I believe, that the US Patents Agency showed that that Marconi's patent had in fact been anticipated by Tesla and granted the patent to radio systems posthumously to Tesla. Mr. T, he was the boy. He really was. But if he hadn't seen Mr. Stubblefield, he would never have understood it. You know, he'd never have observed the natural phenomenon that he went on to model in his own inimitable way to be able to engineer it into an industrial-scale system.
So the Titan here we're talking about is Mr. Stubblefield. Hurrah!
Yeah, he's an unsung hero. He really is. He was an intuitive, creative man, and also a melon farmer.
I was thought you were going to say melancholy.
Well, he was melancholy. He became rather depressed towards the end and locked himself away in his hut, and he, in fact, died in his hut of old age. And he did lots of interesting things. He was forever playing with ground energy, and the neighbours were continually upset because he was making entire hillsides glow in the dark and things like that. But he did some quite amazing things. He did one of his inventions I found quite fascinating was the two parabolic reflecting mirrors that when he was found, his hut was heated by two mirrors, nothing else, two mirrors. And there was a rippling radiation of heat between the two mirrors that he'd carefully aligned. Mirrors he'd made himself.
Infrared standing wave.
It was a standing wave system, but it was obviously being driven by... I kind of worked out how it worked, but he was using ground energy, but he was projecting it into a parabolic resonance system and using the copper to take it down a couple of octaves. But that in itself is clever and incredibly brilliant thing to do. So, he didn't understand the physics of it, but he intuitively knew what he was doing. And in that respect, he was actually ahead of Tesla in terms of being able to just conjure up a concept because nobody told him he couldn't. And he felt that this should work if I try this and this and this. But ultimately, he couldn't define it to be able to refine it to the point he needed to take it to the market. Whereas Tesla, of course, comes along, he's rather like Mr. Spock, and he looks at it and goes, yes, very interesting, I see exactly how that works. And then quietly goes away and does some experimentation, and hey presto, up comes Wardenclyffe Tower. So, really interesting piece of history. And we've lost so much from that era, 100 years ago, the Industrial Revolution, the end of the Victorian era, there was so much in terms of experimental physics and experimental science that has just fallen away because we've gone down other roads and people invented, relativity and transistors instead of things that they had in the day, valves and capacitors. But if that's all you have, then you get really good with valves and you get really good with capacitors. But once you have, quantum physics, relativity, transistors, sub-quantum conducting Fermi level switching devices, then you forget all that's come before, and the potential that things never achieved is still there. And I think there's huge potential for people to take a step back and actually look at some of the older inventions and say, you can take aspects of that, and with what we know now, we can actually do something more with that.
Considering that we're still using the technology from 100 years ago in all of our motor vehicles, I think it's time for an upgrade, don't you, Wynne?
Oh, absolutely. Obviously, electrical vehicles are a good way to go, so long as you can cure the energy storage problem. The alternative to it is to transmit the energy to the vehicle, which is what Tesla was trying to do. I mean, he understood that if Stubblefield could actually send a telephone signal over two disconnected wires across things like water and through air and through ground, then there was no reason why, if you engineer the system properly, you could send that energy directed to a car or a plane or in those days zeppelins and all sorts of things. And he was, that was his vision of the future. If you look at Tesla's vision, he was projecting energy to all these devices. The plane didn't have a big battery, and he had an electric plane that he'd project the energy to. You'd have an electric car that you project the energy to, and a boat that you'd project the energy to. And when you understand where the energy is coming from and how it works, then yes, that can be done with the appropriate technology. The irony of it is that, you know, if that technology was picked up again, you could have, you know, a car that bears his name, and you could actually run it without the battery if you were smart enough to be able to do that.
Yeah, so now the Tesla car, the famous Tesla car, he had this, I can't remember what model it was, but
it was a 1931 Pierce Arrow, I believe.
Thank you, sir. Cause, you know, you'd remember that sort of. But he had this car and it was a long car, you know, it was one of these long kind of monsters-like cars.
And importantly, it had a wooden frame.
It had a wooden frame and it had a massive aerial on it.
It had a 6-foot long antenna curved in the back of the wooden body at the back, yes.
Yes, because I would say that's a DB27, mate.
On a biscuit. I used to have one of those
on a biscuit tin.
Yeah, yeah.
DB27 on a biscuit tin, mate. No, nobody will understand what I just said.
If the VAR era and from the UK and the old CB days, the old DB27 aerial was the quarter wave CB aerial, which was actually very efficient as an omnidirectional aerial, I seem to recall.
Yeah. So it was, you know, a little what they call compression coil. No, I can't remember what they call it. A loading coil at the bottom.
It was a loading coil, indeed. Yeah.
long time ago. Standing wave ratios and meters.
The days of convoy and, you know, and rubber duck and all that sort of stuff. Yes, it was great.
Like we got ourselves a convoy. Break 1-9.
Yeah. Yeah. So it had something not dissimilar to that, curved in the back of the car. Yes.
Yep. So.
Imagine a dipole version of that.
And he could have probably even added a radio phone to that system at some point. You know, if he'd have developed it.
Technically, he could have added the Stubblefield telephone system to it. Yeah, because what the car was doing was picking up the ground energy system from the ground. It was producing a field at the back of the car that was coupling to the ground energy. And it only had to travel 6 feet at a time to keep touching to each of the Hartmann grid points and picking up another surge of energy, which then the control system in the front of the car was smoothing out through a small capacitor and valve system and then producing the energy for the motor in the front.
Okay, so, but we'd need a Wardenclyffe though, wouldn't we?
Well, he was using a Wardenclyffe for that, but, the point is, you don't need a Wardenclyffe if you can create your own. So the same way that the Moray system, which was self-powering, you know, didn't have a battery in it anywhere. He started off with the tiniest radio signal in the atmosphere and then tuned it and built up the resonance until the whole system went resonant and then the thing coupled to the ground and then the energy poured out. You can do the same thing. We have computerized electronics that can do this now. So you could have a system that is creating the excitation field for the ground coupling from second to second as the vehicle travels and be able to connect from node point to node point as it goes down the road. You'd only have to have a normal sort of car battery size storage to excite the system and get it moving. Once it was moving, it could continually pick up energy as it goes down the road. If it was properly designed. There are issues with high voltage engineering but it's all doable. It's all doable if people wanted to.
And, when you drive a car and you drive along the car and, you step out of the car and you just reach back to close the door and you get like, you know, a good spark. Can that energy be sent into the motor instead of being my heart?
That's effectively what's running it. Then the energy that's coming out of the ground is closer to static electricity than it is to normal sort of AC generated electricity.
Oh, I see. So that's why you say it's a different flavor of electricity.
Yeah,
it's like the globe is a Van de Graaff generator, yeah?
Yes, it is. If you can think of it as a modulated static field, that's what it is. But it's also self-entraining down its own little self-cohering conduction pipes. If you look at Maxwell's equations, one of the things that longitudinal electrical signals do is self-cohere. So they travel rather like an electrical smoke ring. So they stay together in that coherent focus form. They don't dissipate the way that transverse waves do. Transverse waves radiate from a point and disperse, whereas longitudinal waves travel effectively as self-cohering smoke ring type of structures that actually focus back to the back to the point that they're travelling to.
Wow. Little vortices that are sprained out from the transmitter, yes? Ah. So, yeah, we've got about 20 minutes left.
Yes, I mean, the future of electric cars, if we, you know, if somebody had a concerted effort, you know, if I had a lot of resource, for instance, and there was a concerted effort to do this, you could make electric cars that didn't require anything more than a standard car battery to fire it up, and then it would take its main power from travelling around the planet, just rather like an electrostatic scale electric. You know, that's that is possible. We're sitting on an enormous electric field. The only thing is, you have to have a system that's, that puts itself sufficiently out of equilibrium from the field that you're tapping, to be able to convey it into a phase lead lag system to be able to drive a motor. That's all you have to do, and we naturally have that in the fact that you have different resonant frequencies in the air cavity and you have different resonances in the ground cavity. So it can be engineered, and Tesla understood that quite clearly.
So here we have now here's the trick today is, because we have a changing Schumann resonance. Now, I believe this Schumann resonance is changing because the size of the Earth is changing.
No, it's changing because an overturn frequency was attached to it in July 2010. I was there when it happened. The interesting thing with the ground energy is it's also connected to consciousness. This is one of the reasons I spent so many hours in wet fields looking at crop circles forming. You know, not the ones that, you know, Bob and Dave are the plank. You know, we're looking at the real ones that are being made in front of your eyes with apparently nothing forming it, but with the association of a consciousness and obviously some sort of energy. I mean, I've sat there and watched two entire acres of actual corn go down in less than 9 minutes. You know, that's you do well to do that with a combine harvester. That requires a certain amount of energy. And the thing I'd concluded was that the ones I was tracking, I mean, it's a very complex, basically a very complex environment, the crop circle phenomena up to 2010. Many, many things are going on. But certainly the ones I was tracking were a consciousness interaction with ground energy. Now, the interesting thing that I learned from measuring, looking at ground energy, and this is, you know, people saying, how is it you managed to film so many of them? Well, I was measuring the ground energy. I could tell when the energies were at a level where something was quite probable. I could detect which field it was likely to happen in. And when you start delving into it, you find that actually the energy that's going through the ground is very much connected to consciousness. So as much as it's energy of the planet, it's also part of the consciousness energy of the planet. So it is quite a fascinating thing and quite complex, really. It's not sort of the electricity we're used to dealing with, in that there is also a consciousness component to it. But, that it's also, as you said, connected to the Schumann resonance frequency, which used to be 7.5 hertz. But what actually happened in 2010 was that there was an extra energy component injected into the Earth energy grid system. And that was an overtone frequency, and that has caused a conditionally stable, chaotic expansion of Schumann frequency possibilities now, which means that it can frequency double. As consciousness raises, there is actually a higher frequency available within the consciousness energy grid of the planet for consciousness to actually evolve into, and that's what we've seen happening. And we've seen that being the injection point, but we've seen that the process by December 2012 has reached a point where people's consciousness is starting to polarize, in that people that are more positive are connecting to higher frequency components of consciousness and to more positive ways of thinking and being, and the negatives are going the other way. And they're getting left behind, and they're going to stuck down there at 7.5 hertz, whereas everybody else is going up from one to the other to the other to the other of these overtone frequencies, the Schumann resonance. And so we're kind of evolving with the consciousness potential of the planet. It's really quite exciting.
It is very exciting indeed. And so, yes, if we were saying that, you know, we were measuring the brainwave frequencies of a person, the Earth, if you like, has been deeply asleep and is now coming up to being awake, going up to the next octave. Because when you look at frequencies, you know, at those low frequencies, very small makes a big difference. So 7, I was looking before, 7.83, which is kind of the accepted, well, one of the accepted, some people say 8.6, but anyway, is a B, is a note of B. Interestingly enough, F sharp is a fifth of B. There's a geometric relationship.
And the crop circles were geometric forms.
Yeah, so.
And I've always seen it as, basically, it's like an alarm clock going off. The planet's consciousness was, you said, oh, it's wake up time.
1444 PST just now.
Is there any consciousness on my planet that on the surface of me that can understand what this is and evolve with me?
Yeah.
And that was a big part, I'm sure, of the crop circle phenomenon from late 1980s right through to 2010.
Indeed. So, this is, the subject of frequencies always, you know, switches me on. And also the idea that everything has its note. You know, people just talk about frequencies and this and that. But when somebody talks about frequency, I look at it in terms of what's that note and what effect does that note have on people? You know, every note affects a piece of the body. Every note, every piece part of the body has a frequency that, strangely enough, when there's disorder in it, it's very, very closely connected with the frequency of the day of their birth.
That's interesting.
This is from the sound healing empirical work by Shari Edwards she's done. It's fascinating. I got to talk. Check it out on the last round table I did with Shari and a couple more healers. It's a very interesting little conversation about these relationships, and they discovered it accidentally, empirically.
That's quite astounding.
Yeah. Basically everybody's got a signature frequency in a nutshell. And
well, everybody's DNA has a signature frequency. That's why we're in the bodies we're in. I've had out of body and near death experiences in my life, and you realize when you re-enter your body that your soul is only capable of connecting to a certain range of DNA signatures. It's that frequency, that resonance of that particular DNA signature that allows my soul to connect to it. And so yes, I can see how that could work.
So what they then discovered is that one of the workers there just idly one day mapped their birth date against their issue and their frequency, and discovered that there was a 40% relationship, direct relationship, and a 40% opposite relationship. Wow. So that means that 80% is directly which is also directly related. So there's an 80% correlation between
that must be the basis of astrology then.
Yeah. Yeah. Or it's a proof. It certainly proves the idea that frequencies can have an effect on, or that, you know, it's not that frequencies have effects, it's that we are frequencies, and that we are the expression of frequencies.
Well, there's only two things in this universe, and that's energy and information. Hmm. And matter is just energy slowed down. there is nothing else apart from resonance and consciousness.
And so, we talk about our energy systems, and, needing electricity to light our houses.
We're sitting on a planet that is a huge electrical generator and saying there's an energy shortage.
Exactly.
There isn't.
Exactly.
There's only a shortage of people who can put a meter on the energy. It's ridiculous. You know, it's absolute insanity. And I think everybody's waking up to this fact now that, you know, we're in a universe that's constructed almost entirely of energy. There cannot possibly be an energy shortage.
That's right. That's right. So, Wynn, tell people about things that you offer. A website. You have the Ridgeblade system, other things. You know,
yes.
Do you do advice things?
I've advised all sorts of people and large corporations, and that's what I do. I see my forte as an innovator. Mm-hmm. Certainly since my consciousness expanded via the crop circle process, I see the thing that I can do that most people can't is to innovate and visualize complex and advanced technologies that most people don't understand, and hopefully try and convey it to people in a way that they can. But I do renewable energy generation. I do an awful lot of innovation in that area, and the Ridgeblade was my first product. I've had a decade of experience in that, but also energy storage systems, as the MGRIS microgrid system coming out from me. There's a very exciting product I'm about to launch called the Heat Grabber, which is basically a low-cost but very effective solar thermal collection system that you can put in a DIY form in your house and be able to get free hot water and free heating for your house, but at about a fifth or a sixth of the cost of an equivalent system. That's going to be available in the next 2 months. Those are the things I've started with. But my ultimate aim is to make all my technology redundant by better technologies that's more affordable, more ecologically sensitive, and more appropriate. And so we have a progression path that we can all use something that doesn't damage the environment, but gives us an advanced standard of living and, our own, independence, really, our own sovereignty to create our own energy, use it as we wish, and be able to use that energy to improve the world. For instance, if you could create energy at a low enough cost and in enough available places, you could produce any amount of fresh water. You know, we're a planet that's 70% covered in water, but we can only drink a small percentage of it.
Water everywhere, exactly.
Yeah, but the only thing that stops you being able to produce clean drinking water for everybody is the energy cost and requirement to do that. If you could have sufficient amounts of energy available that's non-polluting on the planet, everybody can have clean drinking water.
Absolutely. So I've got one last thing. This is sort of, and finally, potentially this is a humorous thing, but there's been going around the internet, there's been this little arrangement of a magnet and cores. It's like they use, some very thick copper wire, and they take a little, they coil it, and then they have another coil tail that is soldered to the middle of it. Mm-hmm. And
nonsense.
Yeah, it is just a little thing, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of things. There's a lot of people, playing pranks. A lot of people, genuinely trying to do things and sometimes misunderstanding what it is they're doing. And then there's a good number of people that are actually making good progress in many different ways. Mm. And, it's an exciting world. It's, we're going to see, the way we view our world change, I think, over the next 5 to 10 years enormously.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we have to get away from, like, look, we've seen what nuclear power does, right? We don't want that anymore, right? Everybody's going to say, look, should we build some more of those? And they say, no. And, how about coal? Well, you can't deal with the ash, can you? No, we can't. Okay, well, we don't want that either. How about this stuff? You just stick a ball in the air, and everybody gets power. How about that?
Yeah, exactly. Well,
Give us it, or we'll cut your knees off.
I should be giving that to everybody, because something like that is so disruptive to the existing corporate environment that the only way you can do that is to give it to the planet.
Absolutely.
Just give it to everybody. That's the only way. The reason you've never seen it before is that if anybody tries to make any money out of it, they will immediately be stomped on.
That's right. So we do it in a way that nobody makes money from it.
It's a
charitable organization, or it's a local community project thing that a bunch of people can get together and do in a local area.
Yeah, well, I think people are going to, I think with the economic changes that are likely to occur quite soon, I think people are going to wake up to the fact that we need to work with each other and trade with each other in slightly different ways than we have, and on a much more horizontal level in a more distributive system. And I think we'll see that, and I think with that will come a greater personal responsibility and community responsibility, and I think then it's possible to roll out these kind of systems.
So, with all that, thank you very much, Wyn Keach. You've done another great download of useful information here for the people, and
we didn't really get into charge controllers too far, but we seem to go off on a tangent a bit, but at least people can go off and save the planet now.
Yeah, go off and save the planet. We're giving you all the blueprints. If you can't get the blueprints off the show, they can get the blueprints off of Wyn, or, you know, they're not really blueprints, but, they're mental blueprints. Come and get the mental download. Tune into
Wyn.
That's it.
I'm putting it into the group subconscious. People can draw this out now and it'll start springing up all over the place.
That's right. Seeding it. Thank you very much. This has been Full Spectrum with JP and Wyn Keach. Thank you very much, man. Good night, mate.
Yes.